This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Among all the measures required in preventing COVID-19 spread is restriction of movement. That is what we call lockdown. So, but in the present circumstance, it has not been effective.
That is a senior lecturer at the University of Lagos on enforcement of COVID-19 prevention measures after Nigeria eased lockdown restrictions. Details coming up also. Five West African countries and their ally France are meeting today to discuss ways of stopping jihadist attacks in the Sahel region. And gunshots have been heard in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa following the killing of a popular musician known for his political songs. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. With jihadist attacks in the Sahel region becoming all too frequent, leaders from five West African countries and their ally France are meeting today to discuss how to stem the offensive. The insurgency started in northern Mali in 2012 during a rebellion by Tuareg separatists that was later taken over by the jihadists. Despite the intervention of thousands of UN and French troops at that time, the conflict spread to central Mali and neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger. Since then, thousands of soldiers and civilians have been killed, hundreds of thousands have been displaced, and the economies of the three countries, which already were among the poorest in the world, have been grievously damaged. French President Emmanuel Macron is making a one-day round trip to Mauritania for the summit, which is expected to last only a few hours. The sale of two sacred statues from Nigeria at auction in Paris yesterday has stirred renewed demands for Europeans to return objects stolen from Africa. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin filed this story with reporting by Catherine Field in Paris.
A Paris auction house defied a request from Nigerian authorities and activists to halt the sale of two sacred objects that critics say were stolen from Nigeria in the late 1960s. Christie's Paris auction house went ahead with the sale of the objects Monday, selling them off to an anonymous buyer for 117,000 euros. The wooden figures, one male and one female, are carved with elaborate headdresses and facial markings with hands presented forward with their palms facing up. They are called Alosi in the Igbo language of eastern Nigeria, sacred sculptures representing spiritual forces or deities, says Professor Chika Okeke Agolo, an art historian at Princeton University in New Jersey. While it's not publicly known where the Alosi will go now, Okeke Agolo says it's clear where they came from.
They would have originally been installed in communal shrines where sacrifices and offerings are made to the deities that they represent. But that takes the form of ritual, you know, foods and other kinds of substances that are placed in their hands. And that's why, if you look at the two sculptures, their palms are facing up as if to receive things.
Okeke Agolo says it is well documented and published how objects like the ones sold at Christie's were taken out of Nigeria and brought to Europe in the late 1960s. He says the European dealers took advantage of Nigeria's civil war at the time to hire criminals to loot sacred objects and smuggle them to Europe for profit.
During the civil war of 1967 to 70, they were all looted, sold off to European dealers, which they took to Europe and are now in public and private collections.
The professor says the stealing of the objects was done on the ground by Nigerian thieves working for European kingpins.
These were locals, if you will. They are Nigerians, but they are Nigerian thieves because there was a market created for them by these dealers. And that's why I often refer to these dealers as drug lords, right? Because they finance the crime, but from a distance.
The professor alleges that such trade violated the Antiquities Ordinance of 1953 in Nigeria and the 1954 UNESCO Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in the Event of Armed Conflict. Christie's Auction House said the two objects were legitimately acquired and lawfully sold. In recent years, French courts have consistently ruled in favor of auction houses, but public pressure is increasing for European nations to hand back goods taken from Africa. In 2018, French President Emmanuel Macron promised to return 26 looted objects, but has yet to follow through. There are tens of thousands of other objects taken from Africa in French museums. One museum, the Quai Branly Museum in Paris, houses 70,000 African items. Given the slow pace of the return of African objects, some are taking matters into their own hands. In mid-June, five activists dislodged an African funeral pole in the Quai Branly Museum, demanding it be returned. The five will stand trial in September, and one of them, Congolese activist Mwazulu Diabanza, has been barred by a French court from leaving the country or visiting museums. Okeke Agolo says Nigeria's government needs to put more pressure on European countries to stop the trade in stolen goods.
These European collections, private and public, have not cared one bit about the sordid histories of collecting that happened during the colonial period and after. There are legal instruments that can be applied to stopping the sale of illegally exported cultural property. We've seen how that worked with Nazi loots. So this is what I expect from the authorities in Nigeria, to put their acts together to pursue these objects much more robustly.
He also called on any public museums that own looted African objects to come clean about where the objects come from and how they ended up in Europe so that they can be returned to Africa.
For those who think that because Christie's adamantly went on to do their sale today that the story is over, it's not. We're just beginning.
Besides the Nigerian figures, Christie's Monday auction also included pendants, masks, and statues from Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Gabon, Benin, and Democratic Republic of Congo. With reporting from Catherine Field in Paris, I'm Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Washington.
Nigeria says it's lifting some coronavirus restrictions. The Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 said yesterday that President Muhammadu Buhari has approved interstate travel and reopening of some schools, but only for the final year of students. Dr. Livinus Abonia is a senior lecturer in the College of Medicine at the University of Lagos. He told reporter Mike Mbonyi that the development is welcome, but says strict measures should be imposed to ensure COVID-19 prevention rules are followed.
There is no doubt one of the best ways of fighting COVID-19 is prevention. And among all the measures required in preventing COVID-19 spread is restriction of movement. That is what we call lockdown. So, but in the present circumstance, it has not been effective by this current setting. People have been unduly restricted, but the control is not effective. And because of that, people are still moving. And if you look at what is happening, you discover that the incidents in different states of the nation are evening up. That is, you are getting the spread almost uniformly, though we have the major cities of FCT and Lagos. So it is better for us to move to a level that will be a little bit more effective rather than people abusing citizens in the name of restriction while we are not achieving the result of restriction. So now that there is unlocked, people can move from one city to the other, but rather the with guided measures and strict code of, you know, travel to be imbibed by the major transporters. So I would say it's a welcome development. And in one aspect is that the future of the children who are in school at different levels and who need to take the exams is at stake. However, one will argue that life first before we think of education. But by current dispensation, there are options and hope that with proper management, they can continue their studies, these vital exams, while measures for the control will be moved to the next level.
Do you think the decision to approve interstate travels and reopening of schools for final year students has medical implications because of the increase in the number of infections in Nigeria?
The decision to permit interstate travel, it has, of course, obvious medical implications. The tendency is that one who is an asymptomatic carrier or a carrier known with obvious manifestations, signs and symptoms can freely move from one state to the other. And unfortunately, many people are not sincere. They may move and not even disclose the sickness or the fact that such a person is not feeling fine. And of course, that will increase the spread. It has obvious medical implications. The meaning is that all states have to gear up and up the monitoring scale and increase the testing capacity so that people, whoever manifests any signs, should be available, should have the testing facility available so that they can be detected and treated. Thank God our medical team and frontliners are doing very well, and by God's grace, the rate of recovery is quite commendable and encouraging. So the fear of death is a little bit, should be seen as a very remote, except in situations where there are obvious underlying illness or coexisting, what we call comorbidity. Somebody is suffering from something else, and then COVID comes to add up. So there is going to be obvious implications. And what is required is for greater measures.
What can be done to check further infections in view of the recent decision taken by the Nigerian government?
Now that people can move from one part of the country to the other and transact their business or interact with their relations and mass, the implication is that whatever is happening in one part of the state can be replicated in terms of spread in another state. The requirement now is effective control. One measure is enforcement of guidelines for interstate travel. The transporters must make sure that the approved guideline is complied with. Secondly, the law enforcement agents should be retrained and made to enforce the rule without compromise. The challenge we have had is that you pay your way and do whatever you want to do. A set of people to be in charge of this monitoring should be trained very quickly and deployed to ensure that there's complete compliance.
That was Dr. Livin Esabonia, a senior lecturer in the College of Medicine at the University of Lagos, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonier. While there is mounting pressure from the US, the EU and Russia for a ceasefire in Libya, the two warring sides are getting ready for a battle in the strategic coastal city of Sirte before considering any resumption of UN-sponsored talks. Russian mercenaries are actively supporting General Haftar's National Libyan Army in both Sirte and Al-Jufra Air Base, while Turkey is reinforcing forces loyal to the Government of National Accord. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Mufta Tahir, former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, about scenarios in Libya.
The two parties are looking at Sirte as a way of going toward the oil field. Without putting their hands on that, they cannot ensure anything. That's why they are not only considering Sirte, but also they are considering Al-Jufra, which is an air base down in the south, and also considering putting their hands on the oil field. The Wefaq, the GNA, they would like to see Sirte under their control, so they will put an end to Haftar ambitions. That's why Sirte is very important, a very important issue. And the last development is President Sisi of Egypt was the last one who jumped in, and he said that for him, Sirte and Al-Jufra is a red line, and promised to arm and train political opponents of Al-Wefaq, GNA.
Russian mercenaries are actively supporting General Haftar's National Libyan Army in both Sirte and Al Jufra air base, while Turkey is reinforcing the forces loyal to the government of National Accord. Would that lead to an actual military confrontation between the warring sides or to a pressure for negotiating a political solution?
The mercenaries are on both sides, the Russian Wagners with Haftar and in the east. Also, the Turks brought up to 15,000 Syrian militias. No one knows exactly where is this going to lead to peace or to war. But the question still is, why then is this huge buildup? Why is it not only on the ground, but, for example, Russia is building its air power? The Libyans know that they have paid very heavily price for war, and they would like to see an end of it. There's going to be a limited confrontation, at least for these two parties to get rid of this huge armament. And then all of them will have to come to the table of negotiation, which is going to be very painful from both sides to get in there. But it is coming. They will come there, whether they have confrontation or not, because everybody is looking for and waiting for.
Stephanie Williams, acting head of the UN support mission in Libya, said the other day that Libyans are looking for a U.S. role to end the crisis in Libya. Is the U.S. willing to play such a role?
Yes. Even though the U.S. was a little late, the realization in Libya is that speedy intervene from the U.S. as soon as possible. The chances for peace is closer, and especially when we see the failure of other attempts, whether it is from the Arabs or from the Europeans. So especially in the street in Libya, there is a welcome to U.S. to play a more engaging, positive role. In the last few meetings attended by the U.S. ambassador to Libya, there were also military presence, basically the AFRICOM. So we are looking at more positive engagement from the U.S. to settle this. And everybody, including Russia, including Turkey, and everybody else, they know that the U.S. can do that.
So what are the possible scenarios in Libya after realizing that there is no military solution?
I might say that the Libyans are open to all scenarios. The strongest one right now, which is to avoid so many negative things, is federalism. It's going back to three regions, Tripoli, Cyrenaica, Barqa, and Fezzan in the south. The other scenario, which is an ugly one, is division and separation. Because people, when they are fed up and they don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, they might say, well, and let us go to separation. It's not very popular in Libya at all, but it is on the table. The third scenario is to go back to 1951 constitution, which is also going back to federalism. Everyone who's behind every niche scenario is getting his loyals, getting his assets in order to reposition himself so that when they are ready to be called to negotiate, they are ready.
That was Mufta Tayyir, former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Gunshots have been heard in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, and demonstrators set fire to tires following the killing of Haçulu Handessa, a popular musician known for his political songs. Haçulu's songs focused on the rights of the country's Oromo ethnic group and became anthems in a wave of protests that led to the downfall of the previous prime minister. Current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who is also from the Oromo ethnic group, expressed condolences and has asked the public to remain calm. He promised an investigation. The city's police commissioner said late yesterday that some suspects had been detained. Currently, the internet connection to Ethiopia appears to be down, a common occurrence during political protests. The normally busy streets of Addis Ababa and other cities have been empty as protesters lit fires and chanted slogans, with looting and burning of buildings reported in the Oromoya region. South Africa's National Arts Festival is going ahead despite COVID-19 by shifting to online, which means anyone can see it. Now, its 46th year, it runs until July 5th. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
Held in the university town of Makanda, the festival is one of the country's main winter events. This year, on its new virtual platform, it has 250 items on the program. 90% have been especially recorded and uploaded, including the item from the group Ponta Maputo Durban that's playing now. Multi-instrumentalist Machume Zango from Maputo, Mozambique, and jazz pianist Sibusiso Mash Mashulowane from Durban, South Africa, reinterpret each other's works. Mashulowane says he missed the energy of a live audience, but says he's happy the festival is happening despite the challenges. He says the triumph of the human spirit over adversity is what his music is about.
Within the sadness of the colonialism, from just staying together and staying united in my community or in my village, came out beautiful music, which was communal. It's like, hey, we are all suppressed. So what best can we make out of this? Music has become a huge vehicle for the healing. And so in my music, for example, there's a lot of hope that we can do it, we can make it.
A group of African storytellers, which includes a Nigerian and Namibian, are working under the banner Istimela Sendaba. South African Busisiwe Hadebe says they've planned the live production using Zoom and Skype. She's telling the tale of Mochidi, the girl child, saying it's her attempt to preserve the richness of the Setswana language. She says they speak in idioms, proverbs, and expressions. Here's an example of a line which she says makes her story delicious.
Directly translating that means she held her stomach with her hand. But actually what it actually means is that she was so scared and filled with fear that she couldn't move until the danger was gone.
Hadebe hopes her stories will inspire today's generation.
I actually went home where my grandmother used to have a shop back in the day, General Dealer, and she has a stock of these old textbooks that she used to sell to schools, and I translated that. I was just feeling like they are not preserved, and I know when I remember these stories, I can remember the magic that I felt, and I just wanted to share some of that with the children of today.
I asked Festival CEO Monica Newton about her favorite piece.
It's like asking if a parent has a favorite child. I'm so inspired and humbled and grateful to every single artist who took this journey with us and who took a risk on us. But I must admit, having Mama Rossini, the incredible indigenous musician from the Eastern Cape, on the platform is so special. She is unique. Her work is incredible. There are 11 episodes of a documentary about her life, and so we're really going to get to know Madosini.
Madosini has received this year's National Arts Festival Featured Artist Award. Newton says the event's not just for the well-established, there's also a virtual fringe.
We were really concerned about the extent to which artists would independently be able to create revenue for themselves in these conditions. So what we hope will be a legacy of this festival is an ongoing video on demand platform that artists will be able to utilize, where the bulk of the revenue from ticket sales will go directly to them. And we will do a little bit of moderation.
Newton explains how people can access the shows.
The gateway to the entire festival is our website, www.nationalartsfestival.co.za. All of the free content can be browsed through there, and you will certainly be able to buy tickets and festival passes to particular kinds of work.
This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. on behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro. Thanks for tuning and choosing the Voice of America.